Rebel Force Radio presents...
Excuse me, sir. Might I inquire what's going on?
This is RFR Q&A.
Oh, wow, that was a short intro. You can tell I'm really used to doing these. Hey, Rebel Force Radio Patreon supporters, thanks for being here. Got a very fun RFR Q&A just for you. As you know, this is not a show that you can just download off of Apple Podcasts or Spotify or anything like that. No. This is a series of shows that is just for you. RFR Q&A, where we put RFR Patreon supporters in the driver's seat, or in this week's, or in this case, the captain's chair. And joining me is Rob Strecker. Rob, welcome back to RFR Q&A. It's your show, sir. You take the con.
Thank you. How have you been, Ensign?
Oh my gosh, I'm demoted to Ensign. Holy cow. I'm fine. I would love just to be Ensign. I'm at that point in life now where I'm like looking back and thinking, I'd like to be young again. It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this movie that we're about to talk about takes us all back.
Yeah, all the way back prior to the original series. We're talking Trek today.
Of course
we're doing are. The JJ reboot. Part one.
Yeah, part one. I told Rob, I said, I think we're going to need a whole episode to get through the first one. We might be able to get through the second two JJ films in one Q&A. But I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely glad after taking a rewatch of this that we're dedicating a whole episode to this one, because there's a lot here. I really am excited to talk about this one. It's been a while since I watched it from start to finish.
Yeah, me too. And right away, there's a connection to Star Wars in that, not only from JJ, but Michael Giacchino does the music for the movie. And I got to say, I like his main theme for the movie.
I do too. It's one of those that you kind of keep humming to yourself after the movie's over. So it's musical and it's memorable. I mean, I think that's when you're dealing with a franchise where music is so integral to it, the experience, you know, it's no small feat to sort of come up with an anthem or a theme that is impactful as well as memorable. And I think he really did it.
Yeah. I actually had it rolling around in my head for probably a day or two after my last rewatch.
And I appreciate that it sort of does its own thing. I mean, it's not Jerry Goldsmith. It didn't make me forget, you know, Jerry Goldsmith and the greatness of his film, you know, the theme that he came up with for the motion picture and then went on for, you know, to be the theme for Next Generation and, you know, various other movies. But it's it does the job. It does the job nicely. And then the end, the finale suite where they bring in the classic theme, it gave me goosebumps. I loved it. And I thought that the arrangement that they did and then marrying it into his newer stuff was done really, really well.
Yeah. Well, the movie starts out on the USS Kelvin, which incidentally corresponds with the whole timeline that this is called the Kelvin timeline, from when events get changed and it gets split off into this alternate reality where Kirk's dad, George, is the first officer to the captain, who, in my opinion, kind of looks like a younger version of Tam Morrison.
Yes, he does.
Without the veneers. without the veneers.
Right. Yeah, he really does. He's got that Maori, Islander kind of look. Yeah. He looks like a guy you don't want to mess with. That's for sure.
Yeah.
but they make pretty quick work of him on the ship there. Nero and his goons make pretty quick work of him. But, you know, I actually think that they do a really good job in a short period of time. I would say that overall, the thing that's so great about this film is how well it's cast. I mean, even down to the actress that plays Kirk's mom, you just mentioned the actor that plays the captain of the Kelvin. Regardless of screen time, they're cast so well, and they create, I think, an impression. Like, you just have to look at that captain, and you know that he's kicked some ass before in his time. You know, he's got some miles on the tires. And even though they sort of throw you in sort of unfamiliar territory on the Kelvin, you kind of feel like you know what's going on because the characters, I think, being so well cast.
Yeah, you mentioned the cast and how, no matter how short they are on the screen, I'm familiar with the woman that plays Kirk's mom, Jennifer Morrison, from one of the other, or actually two of the other fandoms that I'm part of, Once Upon a Time and House.
Oh my gosh. But, now I remember her from House, now that you say that.
Yes.
I didn't make that connection while watching the movie.
Yeah, she was Dr. Cameron.
Oh. And of course, Chris Hemsworth, you know.
Yeah.
The other Hemsworth.
The other Hemsworth?
Yeah, the other Hemsworth, right? The one that's not Thor.
Oh, okay. And when they're going through the whole thing about Nate, what are we going to name him? She mentions his dad's name, which is Tiberius. And he's like, that's a terrible name.
But yeah, don't do that.
As we all know, it kind of got in there anyway, because he's James Tiberius Kirk.
Yes. Yes. Actually, when my wife and I were naming our son, we had the idea to name him after her late father. And, but his name was Marvin, and he went by the name of, he went by the nickname Bud, because he really didn't like the name Marvin. No offense to anybody out there named Marvin. He didn't care for it. So they named him Bud, or nicknamed him Bud. So we went with the middle name too. So we went with Charles, and that became Parker's middle name. So, that, you know, right away, you know, if you're a parent, that scene, there's a lot of weight to that moment when, you know, you talk about making the ultimate sacrifice, but at the ultimate time. And when I was watching it, I was thinking that, you know, there are some people who believe that infants, newborns, I mean, that from the moment you, even maybe before you're born, that trauma can really leave a mark on a baby, you know, very, very young people, even babies, as I was saying. And so as I was watching that scene unfold, I'm like, I feel like Kirk, Jim Kirk, is being imprinted and marked by this trauma upon birth. I mean, it's a pretty heavy thing for a character. And then of course you see him, you know, very quickly as a adolescent, you know, being a risk taker and breaking all the rules and all of that. I do have a question though for you, Rob, if I may. I know that you're supposed to be asking the questions, but I have a question. So I just started, I began watching Picard season one about a year ago, and I got a few episodes in, and it just, I can't say that I didn't enjoy it. It just, but it didn't call to me every night. Like sometimes when you start binging a show, it calls you, like, I can't go to bed until I watch another episode. It didn't have that impact on me. So I started rewatching it because I want to watch the second season. And, so folks listening, hope you don't mind this little Trekkie diversion, but I'm just going to throw this out there. You know, we find Picard reeling at the beginning of the first season, reeling from this disaster with Romulus and the destruction of Romulus. And I don't know, Trek fans, don't scream at the speakers at me, but is there continuity there? Is the destruction of Romulus that Nero is so crazed about, is that the event that is referenced in the Picard series?
You bring up a good point. I didn't even think of that. And yeah,
it may be. I don't mean to put you on the spot either. It's just something, you know, to think about. So if that's the case, that's kind of cool, because I was hazy on when exactly that incident occurs, just prior to Spock and Nero going back into the past through the wormhole. So maybe it's, I remember hearing at one point that it was like in next gen time frame, but I don't know. If you know, show at rebelforceradio.com. That's the email address. Cause I'd love to know if there's continuity there.
Yeah. That'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah. But as you mentioned, this continuity is broken here at this point. So as you say, the Kelvin timeline, in fact, the three disc set that I bought in preparation for doing these Q&As is called the Kelvin timeline or the Kelvin trilogy or something. So it's pretty well established as that's the branding of this.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the birth scene, it's also during the whole battle where George is trying to evacuate the ship while also still fighting Nero's ship. And the whole time that she's giving birth, all the sound is muted.
Yeah.
Everything is like muffled and quiet until the moment of the birth and the little baby Kirk screams.
Yeah, it's almost like it's the perspective of the baby. Like the baby hears nothing and then the birth, and then it's almost like you're the baby in that moment.
Mm-hmm. And moving on to mentioning Nero, he looks different from the Romulans that we know of.
He does. And I'm watching this today, and again, it had been a couple of years since I'd watched this movie, and I'm like, who is this guy again? Who's this actor that's playing Nero? Is it Christian Bale? Is it Christian Bale? I kept thinking, like, is
Eric
it Bale?
Bana,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Eric Bana. I'm like, why do I know him? And I'm like, oh, he played Incredible Hulk in that terrible Incredible Hulk movie a few years ago. He's great as Nero, but yeah, you know, Star Trek has a history of sort of reinventing the looks or evolving the looks of various aliens. I mean, the Klingons are a great example. They sort of retconned that because, you know, in the 60s, they didn't have the technology, the makeup and the prosthetics and all of that, or the budget, I think, for that matter.
And then it all got changed again when they went to do Discovery.
See, I haven't watched. Okay. Again. I haven't watched Discovery. Did they change the Klingons again in Discovery?
Yeah, they look different even than they do in the TV series that like Next Gen and stuff.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I have not taken a dive into Discovery. But the one,
although this would be also prior to the original series.
Yeah, so maybe they're trying to be sort of a bridge between, you know, the smooth forehead Klingons of the original series and the bumpy headed Klingons in Next Gen. I mean, you actually see the first time you see the bumpy headed Klingons is in the motion picture. And they very, very short lived. One of them played by Mark Leonard, I believe. Sarek of the original series. I think they throw him in as a Klingon again. And they meet V'ger.
Yeah. And then the very next scene in the movie, where you're fast forward probably about 12 years, I would think, and he's speeding down a road in his stepdad's automobile.
Yeah,
and I'm sitting sports car. Thinking, there's cars and roads and cell phones in this time. Isn't this supposed to be like 200 years in the future from now, and they're still...
Sure is.
Using roads?
Yeah. I believe if you look closely, that's the iPhone 480 model that he's got there.
I thought it was almost a Nokia.
Oh, was it? That's right. Yeah, they had to get product placement in there. I'm sure it was. I actually sort of like that. I like that vision of the future. I get your point. It does seem detached from what we would assume, but keep this in mind, Rob, you know, back, it wasn't that long ago, you know, like our folks' generation were growing up and they thought they were going to have flying cars by the year 2000. So on the one hand, technology does seem to move at a pretty exponential rate. But on the other hand, it's like, we still don't have flying cars. So who knows what 2300 is going to look like. But yeah, I would guess that car that he's driving would have been hundreds of years old, right at this point. Yeah. It looked super hip for 2009. I don't know anything about cars. I'm with you. It did the vision of the future, while I found it somewhat comforting because it wasn't too bananas, did seem a little kind of far-fetched considering that they were, you know, a few years later, they're going to build the Enterprise, you know, down the street from that in the cornfields of Iowa.
And then as he's speeding down the road, he takes a moment to turn around and, whoa, sorry, wave to a friend.
Yeah, okay, so have you listened to the audiobook of this Star Trek movie?
No.
All right. So I don't believe that it ever came out in print. I may be wrong, but initially, at least, it was only released as an audiobook, and it was read by Zachary Quinto. And I listened to it the summer that this came out. And there is some backstory to that opening scene. Now, if this is fresh in someone's mind, I may be getting some of these details a little fuzzy. But what I recall is that's Kirk's that's his stepbrother that he waves to. I believe stepbrother. And I think his name is Sam. I think he says, if you have the subtitles on, it might be Sam, because in Star Trek, I believe Kirk has a brother named Sam in the original series. It's referenced, I believe. And by the way, this is called Star Wars Guys Talking Star Trek, right? Everything is predicated with, I think. So that's who he waves to. And it's implied in the book, in the audiobook, that the relationship with stepdad is not great, that it might be abusive, and that, you know, mom is absent a lot. What I remember from reading that is that it was a pretty troubled childhood, and that he was kind of the unfavorite son because, you know, new dad comes in, you're not mine, you know, that kind of thing. So I think that's who he was waving to.
Yeah, you get that sense from the phone call that his relationship with stepdad was not good.
And it certainly wasn't going to be good after that.
Oh, no.
I'm looking here. And then, I was just going to look real quick. I had, get this. The stepdad's voice is Greg Grunberg. So Greg, who shows up in every JJ movie. Let's see. I was looking to see where the kid was in the cast. Let's see, where is he? Is there another Kirk? I'm not finding
it. It wouldn't be Kirk if
oh, that's right. That's right. You're right. It wouldn't be him. Anyway, we'll figure that out offline, but keep going. Don't let me derail you.
And then as he's speeding down the road further, he comes across a cop that, to me, I wonder if it's an android.
That's cool. The first thing I thought of was Adam West's Batman, because I love the way he said, citizen, like, pull over, citizen, or whatever he says. And that's what Adam West Batman always called every, you know, the citizens of Gotham, citizen. I didn't take it as an android. It's a cool idea that it might be. That sure would be a lot safer way to have, you know, police.
Because you don't see a human face there really at all. It's all covered up by something.
Yeah, you're right. You don't. So could be, but already in trouble with the law.
Captain. Yeah, especially after ditching the car and sending it over a cliff. Much to his stepdad's dismay and his probable glee.
Oh, can you imagine what that thing was worth?
Oh.
We're talking about like a 200 and some year old car.
Yeah. And a class, certainly a classic by then.
Oh. My Volkswagen Jetta in the garage would be a classic in 250 years if it was still around.
Yeah, you got to, although they've got replicators that make parts and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
That would be, I was just going to say, how would they keep the maintenance up on those? And I'm like, well, they've got replicators.
Yeah. I didn't think about that. I mean, oh my gosh, imagine what these collecting purists would think about that when you can just replicate a vintage action figure out of the little microwave thing in your house. That'd be amazing.
And then going out at the same time as this, we cut away to a young Spock at the Vulcan school getting picked on by the pure Vulcan children. And I just love the line, I presume it is time for your daily insults to try and provoke an emotional response.
Yeah. Right. I mean, that's one way to deal with bullies.
Yes, but they do succeed at it when they bring his mother into it and that they feel that his dad's a traitor for marrying her. That provokes a response from him.
Yeah, and that's kind of foreshadowing, too, for what Kirk later needs to do at future Spock Prime's suggestion, which is to do something to where he has to sort of out himself as being emotionally compromised. And it's like, so we learn early on that his Achilles heel is his mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, isn't that, for all of us? I mean, we all would most likely defend our moms.
Yeah. It surprises me in this whole trilogy, just how emotional Spock is.
Yes. Yeah. Much more so than Leonard Nimoy Spock of the original series. And
unless you count the original pilot episode.
That's right. Yes. The original where he's smiling, in Where mm-hmm. No Man Has Gone Before, I believe. And even, I can't remember exactly if that, I think this, or is the smile in the cage? But I know what you're talking about. I think he laughs in one of the pilots. Yeah, it's different. And the thing about, I mean, Quinto is, just marvelous in this part, I think, especially in this first movie. And the fact that he developed such a close relationship with Leonard Nimoy, and Leonard Nimoy was very available to Zachary and just spoke so highly of him. And there was so much respect, mutual respect between the two. You just couldn't get a better handoff of a something like that than they handled it so well. And, we certainly don't want to turn this into a Star Wars show, but I actually picked up my phone and texted Jim and Bill, Jimmy Mac and Billy Mac, and said, "Hey, I'm rewatching Trek 2009. I forgot what a fantastic movie this is and how marvelous Quinto is, and it proves that J.J. Abrams can do something like this right when it comes to legacy characters, legacy actors, and all of that." So I think he gets a lot right in this. And in fairness, he got a lot right in The Force Awakens, too, for that matter. He really did. It just fell apart beyond, I think, afterwards. But certainly Spock is different, I think. I think you're absolutely right. He has his... I think it's where Quinto was definitely making it his own, and I'm sure Nimoy was pushing him to do that. But at the same time, there are a lot of nods, and I think Chris Pine talked about trying to sprinkle in some Shatnerisms here and there. And there's one in particular at the very end of the film when he shows back up on the bridge and he goes, "Bones." Like, yes. it's just Shatner to the point where it almost takes you out of the moment for a second. You're like, look at him pulling a Shats. But no, I like that a lot. And then there's a great Zachary Quinto eyebrow raise as Pike. When Pike is leaving to board the Romulan ship and he puts Spock in command and he says something about, it's a new ship, take care of it or something like that. And he gives that Nimoy.
Yeah, I actually had that written down later as a comment. Yeah. Careful with the ship. She's brand new.
Cocked eyebrow. Fascinating.
Yeah. Fascinating indeed. One other note I had before we move on, remember the temporal police from Enterprise and Daniels? I wonder where the heck they are in all this.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now you're taking...
Because this is a pretty big disruption in the timeline.
Yeah. Man, I didn't even think about the impact of that. That's really interesting. I don't know.
Unless it's not something big enough, like preventing the formation of the Federation.
Yeah, right. Because they actually had to have... Now, what if these events are what inspired Daniels and the temporal police? Would that... Does that, sometimes when we're dealing with like timelines, I'm like, now, can that work? Can that happen? Is that why? But yeah, you would think that the destruction of a planet and, you know, and by extension, a population as significant as the Vulcan race, if that doesn't catch their attention, I don't know what does. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess you could argue that the formation of the Federation and all that likely avoided, you know, perhaps galactic destruction would have been more important, I suppose, than one planet. But that's an interesting angle. I hadn't thought of that.
And then we get to adult Kirk, who... Actually, not quite yet. With young Spock, we see a new actor playing Sarek, and to me, it doesn't quite match up with what I would envision for following in Mark Leonard's steps for the character.
So Ben Cross, I Chariots of Fire, Academy Award winning movie. What I remember Ben Cross from is I'm also a Dark Shadows fan, the old soap opera from the 60s and early 70s. And they did a remake of that in 91. And I remember that year specifically because that was the year, I believe, that the first Gulf War broke out. And it was because of the Gulf War that the show was inevitably canceled because everyone stopped watching network TV and turned on CNN to watch the Gulf War on, it was like you went home after school and after work and turned on the war. It was very strange. And so ratings for a lot of shows, just dropped off. Dark Shadows, the remake, was one of them. It was on NBC. And, so Ben Cross played the Barnabas Collins character. And so I developed like a real affinity for him and a fondness for him as an actor. So that sort of warmed me up. So when I saw him as Sarek, I thought, that's a cool choice. I like that. But I also see, I think Mark Leonard as Sarek, even though he shows up in a couple of episodes and has brief moments in the films, he is an actor who has so much presence on screen that he's easily in my top five Star Trek characters of all time. Mm-hmm. despite a relative. And then, of course, he has that amazing arc in Star Trek: The Next Generation, that connection with Picard. So I'm kind of with you on that one. I think that if you're a real fan of Mark Leonard Sarek, that and don't really have a connection to Ben Cross, it might have been kind of out of left field. I had a connection to the actor before, so it softened me up a little bit. But no, I mean, those are some big shoes to fill. Those are some big shoes to fill. I remember as a little kid seeing Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, for the very first time. And that I love that scene when the Klingon ambassador is you know, talking to the Federation about Kirk, and he's a murderer, and he's a this, and he's a that. And Mark Leonard or Sarek has that incredible entrance, and he's there to defend Kirk and the crew and all of that. And it's so cool. So yeah, he definitely made a big impression on me, Mark Leonard Sarek. So.
Yeah. Okay. Then we get to the adult Kirk, and he's, in a bar drinking, and he's trying to hit on a young Uhura and obsessed with trying to find out what her first name is.
Yeah. It's a great gag that runs throughout almost the whole movie.
I don't think even, did we know what her name was before, back in the originals, or was it just always just Uhura?
I think that her first name is revealed in an episode. I think it is. If not, it was certainly known by the time the convention circuit started and all of that, and the show was in its syndication. So I don't know if it was in fanzines, you know, at the time or where, but I think that her first name has been around for a good long time. It's not one that I would have. In fact, I remember when I just moments ago, we were watching the movie. I'm like, what was her first name? What was it? So yeah, it's not the one on the tip of my tongue. You know, like Hikaru, Sulu. Yeah. Yeah. Or Pavel.
And as the night goes on, he's approached by like a cadet security or something like that. And they're asking her, is this guy bothering you? Oh yeah, but it's nothing I can't handle. And then Kirk just goes, yeah, you just go on, cupcake.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And then starts this whole brawl. And during this whole brawl, we get probably a dream come true for a young Kirk, where his hands happen to land somewhere.
That was great. That was, and the expression that he gives, you know, the big eyes and all of that, that's that kind of clumsy, hammy delivery, I thought was very William Shatner in the best possible way, especially the Shatner of the films, you know, the Shatner of the original series is, you know, he's really taking it seriously. You know, he's playing Shakespeare in that show. And it's similarly to how seriously Patrick Stewart took those initial years of Star Trek: The Next Generation, took it very, very seriously, and then loosened up gradually, and then, you know, became, I think, a lot more likable. But so this Kirk, and here's what's interesting, I think, about Chris Pine's Kirk. So much of this Kirk is based on, I think, a lot of what fans' expectations are of the character.
I could see that.
The blatant disregard for authority is not something that we see a lot in Kirk of the original series. We see that more playful side of Kirk in the films, starting with Star Trek II. And thank goodness for that. I mean, I'm such a fan for what Nicholas Meyer did for Star Trek, and sort of was the, I kind of said that he's sort of like the Irvin Kershner of Star Trek, because he creates so many layers on the characters, like Kersh did with the Star Wars characters in Empire, made them much more believable, much more three-dimensional. And I think that's what Nick Meyer did with the Star Trek characters. So Chris Pine's Kirk feels to me like what, if you kind of retconned the original series based on the way Shatner plays Kirk in the films, that's where I find that Kirk. I don't think Pine would have found the Kirk that he plays in this movie by going back and rewatching the original series.
And I think about it, yeah. He's much more like by the book sort of in this, in the original series.
He is. Yeah. I think there are moments and there's exceptions, but not many. He's a pretty serious guy, you know, except for the end of a lot of episodes where they have a little chuckle, you know, there's a little joke, but you know, McCoy was the one that brought the humor really in the lightheartedness. And it was McCoy and Spock's dynamic, not necessarily Kirk and Spock's dynamic. And this JJ series plays up a lot more of the Kirk and Spock dynamic.
I'll be getting to that in a little bit.
Yeah, good.
speaking of Chris Pine, I do, when I was watching that, I was thinking, hey, Jason kind of bears a little bit of resemblance to Chris Pine.
My daughter said the same thing. She walked into the living room and said, that guy kind of looks like you, Dad. Who is that? As Paul Bateman would say, I remember what time he said to me, there always was a bit of a Kirk about you. So something of a Kirk. There's always something of a Kirk about you. So yeah, I'll take it as a, I wish I was as handsome as Chris Pine. I really do. But I was blown away. I remember when he was cast, I'm like, who is this guy? And then I found out his dad was the guy on Chips. His name's escaping me. It's something Pine. But he was, if you remember the old show Chips from the late 70s, early 80s, there was Ponch and John, and then they had the captain, their boss, and that was Chris Pine's dad. He's one of those actors where you see him and you go, oh my gosh, that guy. He was also, Robert Pine, I think is his name, and he was also in the Munster Go Home. So if you're a fan of the Munsters, they did a major motion picture after the show, or right as the show was wrapping up, and Chris Pine's dad is in that. He plays Marilyn's love interest, and he has a British accent in it. So anyway, I digress. But
and then we get the introduction of the Kelvin timeline Pike.
Yeah, Captain Bruce Pike. Greenwood. Yeah. Man, do I love him. I remember seeing him in 13 Days as JFK and loved his performance in that. He's a great actor. Has a gravity about him. Just commands respect when you see him. I love him. He's so warm, you know, as the character. I love sort of the fatherly attitude he takes with Kirk at the bar and gives him that kick in the pants. And in fact, I mean, in a way, just like, you know, the original Captain Pike that we see in the cage that was supposed to be, you know, the guy before Shatner was cast, he's sort of the prototype for Kirk. All right. I mean, in a literal sense. And then you see in this movie how Pike can, in some ways, is the prototype Kirk. I think that the Chris Pine Kirk models himself a bit after what he's learned from Captain Pike in the Kelvin timeline. So it's kind of like, you know, life imitates art, art imitates life, whatever. But I thought that was kind of cool. Love Bruce Greenwood as Pike. I haven't seen I know there's a new Star Trek series coming on about the adventures of Pike's Enterprise. What is that going to be called? Star Trek?
Strange New Worlds.
Strange New Worlds. And so I haven't watched any of Discovery. Yeah, and that's sort of a spinoff of Discovery, right? So those characters are introduced there. So,
Pike is played by Anson Mount in this new series, and I liked him as Pike during the season 2 of Discovery.
Yeah, so that's where you meet them is in season 2.
Yeah.
Okay. But Greenwood, I think, is great. I really do. Mm-hmm. And I remember watching this movie for the first time and feeling some real anxiety about
Rebel Force Radio.
What was that? Whoa. How'd that happen?
Gremlins. just like the real show.
And I know. Butterfingers. When I watched it the first time, I remember feeling real anxiety about him maybe not surviving, maybe not making it. So whenever a character, if I find myself in a movie going, oh man, I hope they don't die. You know, they've obviously, done something, for me to not want to see that. And I remember thinking that I didn't want to see his, because I wanted to see his character go on into the future of these movies. I didn't know that it would only be 2 more.
Actually, I think it's pretty much confirmed that there's another one now, a fourth one. It was a surprise to some of the actors, but that it was confirmed.
Is that, that's funny. So it's a surprise to the actors, because I think the actors outside of Pine were all signed for another one. So it might be one of those things where it's like, surprise. Remember that contract you signed? Like, 8 years ago?
What I was reading, I was under the impression that they hadn't been signed yet.
Oh, is that it? Okay. I thought they were all ready to go, locked and loaded a couple of years after the last one, except for Chris Pine. And he had scheduling conflicts, and there was all kinds of drama with him.
And I think Chris Hemsworth was supposed to be in it too.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I'm all for it. I'm all for it. I love these characters and these actors. Obviously I love the characters, but I also love these actors. I know that they're, the tragedy of Anton Yelchin is just so awful, because he was such a bright spot of these movies. I mean, especially this first one.
He did a great
Chekhov. He's just terrific, and you just love him. I mean, he's just so lovable and likable. It's just and the things and what you read about him, as a person, it sounds like he was a pretty great guy to be around, and his cast certainly loved him. And it's a real shame. What a crazy accident.
Yeah, and then you have Pike talking with Kirk about his dad and trying to get him to join Starfleet Academy, saying you can graduate in 4 years, have your own ship in 8 and whatnot. And he's thinking about it, and he goes out driving on his moped or whatever, and he's looking up at the Enterprise is being built. And then the next scene, he's driving into the grounds of the departures that are leaving for the Academy and whatever. And he just says, 4 years? I'll do it in 3.
Yeah. Right. I'll see her 4 years and I'll do it in 3. I like that he just throws the keys to one of the maintenance guys to the motorcycle. It's like, it's yours. So he walks up there. He's got nothing. He doesn't have a bag, just the clothes on his back. And he's enlisting, what a great deal.
Yeah. And then before we leave the Earth here, you see all these huge structures that are in silhouette against the background. You just, makes you wonder what these huge structures are.
Probably the most, incredible image as they were promoting this movie coming out, is that shot of the Enterprise there being constructed on the grounds. And, you know, I just thought they did a great job in general of making that all feel very earthy and very real, as opposed to, you know, kind of what the, there's a glamour and a gloss and a glitziness to Earth in the 23rd century that you see in the Star Trek, the classic Star Trek films and into the Next Generation and all that. And, you know, I really liked that there was, kind of a grittiness, a dirtiness, and a realness to it.
Actually, you bring it up, seeing the Enterprise there, and made me think, yeah, maybe those are shipbuilding facilities, those huge structures.
That's what I kind of thought they were.
Before, you know, they get to space,
kind of looked like, and, yeah, what the Enterprise was being, how it was being constructed within, you know, those risers and scaffolding and all of that. That's kind of what I... what I thought. That was what was left after the Enterprise took off.
And then while he gets on the shuttle for departures, he sees the security guy beat him up the other night.
Oh, yeah.
They just kind of give each other a dirty look. And then he smiles when he sees Uhura. And yeah, she's just like,
oh. Wouldn't you? Yeah. I would, if I got on a little cruiser and saw Zoe Saldana, I'd probably smile. Yeah. Yeah. And she, I love that just it's a whole gag, because then later, you know, she shows up, you know, when he's having that little fling with the
green skinned girl. Gaia.
Yeah. Yeah. There, who's her roommate? Oh, that's right. Uhura. And then she petitions to get on the Enterprise.
Mouth
and,
breather.
Yeah.
You heard that?
Yeah.
And on this shuttle, we're also introduced to Leonard McCoy, played by Carl Urban, who does a fantastic job of capturing DeForest Kelly's portrayal of Bones.
He is just phenomenal.
The mannerisms and the way he speaks.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's just outraged about everything, you know, there's a conspiracy behind every door.
Space, you can get all these Corellian ale things and whatnots.
Yeah, he gives him like every possible scenario of things that could go wrong. And I'm, if there was a book that I don't think I ever finished it, big surprise. I have a hard time finishing books sometimes. I think it was called The First Voyage, Enterprise, The First Voyage, book that came out back in the '70s or eighties. I think it was in the '80s. And it was a, like all the Star Trek books, it was never considered canon. It was tie-in material, stuff that fans like to read. It was, I don't want to say it was fan fiction, but it wasn't canon. It was never understood not to be canon. And, at least as far as I know, but there is a version of of how the crew all found each other. And I believe that is, I don't know if that's the origin, but it certainly does tell the story of Bones being a divorcee or recently divorced, not it being an amicable, good divorce. I think it's implied that, you know, he's still deeply in love with his ex-wife, and that he joined Federation as just to get away from everything and kind of forget about her and all of that. So when I first saw this movie, that rang some bells. I'm like, oh yeah, that was his origin at one point. And maybe it was established elsewhere in other materials, but certainly there was in that book. And so I'm just glad that they stayed true to that. And yeah, Carl Urban you know, some people, you know, I remember, especially as the other two movies came out, and they thought that he was overdoing it. I never thought he overdid it at all. I never thought he overdid it. I thought he did it perfectly, because, you know, DeForest Kelly is for as much grief that William Shatner gets for being somewhat hammy as an actor, you know, so is DeForest Kelly. These guys all came up at the same time. You know, I mean, DeForest Kelly was doing Westerns, you know, back in the 50s. And like Shatner was doing, you know, stuff like The Twilight Zone and doing Shakespeare in Canada. I mean, these guys all came out of a very similar sort of school and style of acting. And so I thought that Carl Urban was just perfect and channeled DeForest Kelly amazingly well.
And as the ship lifts off of Earth, he looks over at Kirk and is like, I may throw up on you. Which will come back at a later point.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, that bit reminded me of there's not much, I don't think, to love about the motion picture, but his reappearance, DeForest Kelly's reappearance, is great because he's all pissed off because essentially Kirk did something that, as Bones says,
forced him out of retirement.
Yes, yes, they drafted me. You know, so he's all red assed about it. And so that reminded me, Urban's debut as McCoy reminded me a lot of that sequence and what was going on with the other Bones.
Then it was nice to see the whole Kobayashi Maru scenario finally. It appeared in Star Trek 2.
Yes.
But we didn't see Kirk do it.
Right. We never saw Kirk do it.
We always knew that he had cheated, but we didn't know necessarily what he did other than he changed the variables.
Yeah. Yeah. I changed the rules of the test so that it was possible to win.
Yeah.
I got a commendation for original thinking. I think that was the line in the movie. So he cheated, but
that
passed
didn't happen
him
here.
Right. In this timeline,
that commendation didn't happen.
That's
here.
Right. No. You know, him eating the apple is such a great throwback to when they're on the Genesis in the Genesis cave in Star Trek 2, and he's eating the apple and he takes that bite and he's like, I don't like to lose, you know.
That whole sequence with the Kobayashi Maru is where I thought Chris Pine was emulating Shatner.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Again, because, you know, I think Pine was basing it on the Shatner of the films, and which wisely, you know, he did. And unlike, you know, Zachary Quinto and Leonard Nimoy, Chris Pine and William Shatner spent no time together in the lead up to this movie. In fact, there is a clip. I think it's at the premiere. There, if you go on YouTube, you can find the moment when Chris Pine and William Shatner meet for the first time. And it's at an event. It may not be the premiere of the Star Trek movie, but it was after he had been cast or after the movie had been filmed or something. It was very, very late in the game. And Shatner, I think it's Shatner approaching Chris Pine or someone saying, oh my gosh, Bill, come here, Chris, come here. You guys need to meet. You know, because William Shatner was not happy that he wasn't asked to be in the movie where Leonard Nimoy was. And, you know, I think he can be challenging to deal with. And I think J.J. Abrams just didn't, you know, it didn't serve the story to have them both in it. I can understand why he wasn't in it. I think they could have found something for him to do that wouldn't have undermined Leonard Nimoy's beautiful, you know, farewell performance.
It would have had to have been like a flashback thing, because by the time that Leonard Nimoy's Spock departs the prime timeline, Kirk is dead.
Kirk is dead. That's right. Or is he? Well, he'd have to be ancient.
In generations, he died twice, actually, if you want to think about it. First, when he was sucked out of the Enterprise B into space, and then mm-hmm. again, when Picard brings him out of the Nexus back yes. to that planet, Viridian 3.
Yeah, you know, in the novel, I can't believe I'm quoting the novel. I never do this for the Star Wars stuff. They're going to be like, he hates the Star Wars books, and here he is quoting Star Trek books. And here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to say that in some instances, especially with Generations, the book, and you might say in large measure, the Star Trek books get it better, do it better than the films or the series. That is not the case, in my opinion, with Star Wars. I think the books are far inferior to what we see on screen most of the time. But in the novelization of Generations, it is actually McCoy and Spock that witness Kirk's death. That's what it was supposed to be in the original script. It was not supposed to be Chekhov and Scotty. It was supposed to be...
Actually, nobody witnesses it.
Well...
They just come down and see the damage
right.
from where he
yes.
was.
Yes, because they had to deal with the prophecy of, when I die, I'll die alone. That's what he's always mm-hmm. known. So, yes, you are correct. But the initial aftermath, that was supposed to be Bones and Spock with him. So in the novel, and then Shatner wrote let's face it, I'm sure he had them ghostwritten, but he might have come up with the story ideas. There was an idea that was posed that Spock and McCoy would go visit the grave of Kirk on that planet when he died from Malcolm McDowell and Picard was there. I don't know the name of the planet, but when the bridge fell on him or whatever it was, and he's got that shallow grave with that pile of rocks over top of him. And so you got Spock and McCoy there remembering their friend. They turn away and they hear the sound of a transporter beam, and they look, and all the glowy lights you can see in the cracks of the rocks, and clearly Kirk's body is being beamed elsewhere, and he then later is brought back by the Borg.
Huh.
So there's a book called Resurrection by William Shatner, and I think it's a trilogy or a duology of stories. So anyway, that's a tangent, but
back
still,
to the Kobayashi
back
Maru.
To the Kobayashi Maru. Yeah.
We find out that Spock is the one who programmed that whole scenario, mm-hmm. and he's none too happy with the fact that Kirk messed around with it.
Yeah, no, he's ticked off.
We see that play out in the trial, for lack of a better phrase, I guess, before the academic council
tribunal,
or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I believe I have the right to face my accuser.
Yeah, and that certainly gets his relationship with Spock off to a really rough start. And that's a, you know, pretty, maybe not risky, but I mean, I think it pays off. But I mean, if I was sitting there writing an origin story of these characters, I don't know that I would have taken the angle that they were going to start off as, you know, enemies, become frenemies, and then become good friends. But it works. It really does work. I think they move a little too fast on the friendship in the second movie. You know, when they sort of give you the inverse death of Spock moment, yeah. We're supposed to be all busted up about it. It's like, wait a minute, these guys have known each other for what, like a year? You know, whereas Kirk and Spock and Wrath of Khan, you know, had been, you know, you had this sense of long friendship and history. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they start off in a rough patch, and yet it's Prime Spock that has to sort of convince Kelvin Kirk, that, you know, he shouldn't be so quick to write off that friendship. And then he kind of gives Kelvin Spock a similar speech at the end of the movie, that, you know, you guys need each other, and the galaxy needs the two of you to be together. Yet he's so insufferable. Quinto Spock is just, he's a real wet blanket. He's not
real stickler for the rules.
Oh gosh. It's nauseating. Yeah. But you're supposed to feel that way about him, I think.
And we don't hear an official ruling from the tribunal there, but we find out in the later scene that while this is going on, they get the distress call from Vulcan about Nero's appearance and whatnot. Well, it's not known at that moment, but
sure,
we know they're all going off to get their. They're all going off to get their ship assignments, and you get the fun scene with Uhura and Spock, where she wanted to be on his ship, and I'm supposed to be on this ship, and he's like, I believe you are, in the end.
Oh yeah, isn't that even Spock? You know, he understands. He knows how it goes with the girlfriend or the wife. You know, I mean, he gives her a very logical explanation as to why he did not assign her to the Enterprise, and you know, in a characteristic girlfriendy kind of way, she goes, "Yeah, okay, I get it, but I'm on the Enterprise." He's like, "Yes, I believe you are, lest my bed be extra cold tonight." So that's a surprisingly human, or maybe that's just something that's just universal in all species. But yeah, that I appreciated that as well.
But it's in this sequence that we find out that Kirk wasn't assigned a ship because he's been put on academic suspension, I think it was said.
Yeah, he's in timeout. He's in timeout, and they're grounded, as they say.
Yeah, and Bones comes up with this elaborate scheme to bring him along.
Yeah, right off the top of his head. Yeah.
Injects him with some sort of vaccine that mimics the symptoms of something.
Yeah, and then he ends up having a real reaction to that, and that's, you know.
Yeah, his hands swell up.
Right.
And that's where the whole line comes up again later, because as they're lifting off to go up to the Enterprise, then Kirk turns to Bones and says, "I may throw up on you."
Yeah, right. That comes back full circle, and then, you know, he approaches Uhura with those big hands, and it's like, oh, this guy again, he's very handsy. Those hands keep getting bigger.
And then as they're heading up to the ship, we get the most beautiful sight in all of Star Trek, the Enterprise.
Yeah, and thankfully they don't take, you know, 45, 50 minutes to show you the ship like they do in the motion picture. I mean, we get some nice beauty shots, and they take their time, but it's not, you know, good God, doesn't slow down the movie too much.
Not sure what it is about it, but that is a gorgeous ship.
Oh, it's a classic. I mean, there's, you know, it's a classic in every sense of the word. I mean, it was a beautiful design even for its time. And it just, yeah, it's just got great aesthetics to it. The symmetry of it, you know, playing off of the flying saucer, you know, trope, but then adding to it, you know, even the Millennium Falcon kind of plays off the flying saucer idea, you know, the most recognizable interstellar craft design, you know, we as humans have conjured up, maybe, or seen, who knows, but regardless, it's certainly in our minds. And so it builds really nicely off of that. So it's like, yeah, it's like a classic automobile. Like we see it and we're like, it's a classic for a reason.
And we get introduced to the other members of the main characters, Chekhov and Sulu, up on the bridge, and we get this comedic moment where Sulu, the great pilot, forgets to take the parking brake off or something like that.
Yeah, it's sort of the equivalent, I guess, of the parking brake. But yeah, he gets off to a rocky start, you know, but it's a great little moment to humanize the character that goes on to become the greatest helmsman and, you know, maybe all of Starfleet. So yeah, it's, you know, we all have that first day on the job.
And then you have the Chekhov making the shipwide announcement about their mission and input the authorization code. And at first it's just Victor, Victor.
Yeah.
And then he has to slow down and to make it a V sound.
Yeah, no one has any, I like, because they show everybody like scurrying around and, you know, no one has a clue what he's saying over the PA. It's just like, you know, when you get the first time you ride the subway in New York and it's like, next stop. You're like, what? I don't know. I don't know. Is that my, so yeah, it was just, it's funny how they put the foreign guy on the PA.
But we know of one person who was paying attention, and that was Kirk, because he bolts up when he hears the mention of the lightning storm.
Yeah. And yeah, that's when you realize that he is.
He knows the story of
the
storm.
He knows the story. Yes, yes. That's when you realize, because the Kirk that you meet at the bar doesn't care. He's not impressed by what his father did. He's angry at his father, thinks maybe he made the wrong choice or the whatever. And when he perks up at that detail, and then he tells Pike, sir, you know, I read your, cause I think Pike said that he wrote his thesis or something important, wrote documentation about that incident, the Kelvin incident. So yeah. That was cool. That was when you realize that he is smart. He's not all instinct. Like, he can take information in and recall it.
First he runs to Uhura, who sees a big hand. But that he runs to her because of overhearing the conversation from underneath the bed that she was having with her roommate the previous night about picking up that transmission.
Yeah.
And when he confirms that, then they go racing up to the bridge, and Spock is like, you're not supposed to be here, and they're talking over each other trying to get Pike's attention. And then we get reintroduced to Nero, who I love his opening line there. Hi, Christopher, I'm Nero.
I go back and forth with his performance here, this character, Eric Bana's Nero. On the one hand, he looks great. I love the design of the character. I love how he fits that ship, and which is really, by the way, a bizarre design. I mean, you can't walk around it. I mean, it's worse than your attic, you know, before you put like the planks down, like you've got to literally like leap for your life, you know,
wasn't it like a garbage open ship or something like that?
Yeah. I guess I don't know, but, so he fits the environment real well and everything, but he's almost a little too casual for me.
Yeah. That line,
let me tell you, seemed out of character. You know, calling everybody there by their first name. And he remembers everything, you know, like he remembers Kirk, seeing Kirk's picture in, you know, newspapers. Spock, he recognizes, even though he's much, much younger. There's a lot of convenience found in that character, you know, like just kind of just go along with it. Go along with it. I mean, the fact that, you know, what they just hung out in space for 25 years waiting for Spock to come through that wormhole. You know, I mean, he's a psychopath, obviously. Psychopaths do all kinds of, you know, things that seem, you know, that's what makes them crazy. They do crazy things, sitting around doing nothing for 25 years. I don't know how you would live on a ship for 25 years waiting for that moment. Like, did they all go, like, get jobs? And then, you know, I'll meet you back here in 25 years. So that was a bit of a suspension of belief for me. But most of my suspensions of disbelief happen around the character of Nero, honestly.
Then we have the scene where that one crazy dude, along with Sulu and Kirk, are skydiving onto that platform.
Oh, man.
I just made note of those have to be some incredibly shock-absorbing suits to be going down full speed, terminal velocity, and to impact on the surface and not just be totally crushed to death.
Yeah. Well, hey, amazing what technology brings. I mean, yeah, it's a great stunt. I mean, I was reminded of the guy that has the world record for longest jump, highest jump. He actually a free fall or whatever it was. Remember, he was just at the, I forget how far up he was, but he did a big jump, and, It was like that, but
from the edge of space, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was just on the edge of space, exactly. And I was thinking a little bit about that. I'm like, oh, that guy did that, but you know, I think they were obviously a little higher up. It's a great stunt. It's a great sequence. I love that the one guy wearing the red suit gets killed. He's hot dogging.
Burned alive.
Yeah. It's pretty grisly way to go. But you know, when they launch out of there and he's the only guy wearing red, you know, in Star Trek.
Oh yes.
Yeah, he's probably not long for the world. So
I didn't even think about
shirt,
that.
The red shirt is out of there. I remember it getting a laugh in the movie theater. It really did. But I love that whole scene. I thought the whole sequence was great. Watching this thing in 4K was. Yeah, it brought me back to seeing it like I did in the theater. I mean, it's and the details in that sequence and in the finale when they're on the ship and having their big fight at the end is just fantastic. It's really well done. I thought the stunts were great. It wasn't so wacky that I was like, ah, come on. I mean, I felt it. It was nerve-wracking to, it was nerve-wracking to watch.
And then this whole idea of the red matter, I just found kind of perplexing because you got this big blob of this stuff in this tube on that ship, but it only takes a little bit to start the process of creating that singularity inside the planet.
Yeah, why'd they need so much red goo?
And what keeps it so stable that it doesn't just create the singularity right there on the ship?
Yeah, there was... My mom used to make this bread where it was like... I forget what it's called. Like, it's either like monkey bread or friendship bread or something like that. And you let the dough... You make the dough and you let it ferment... And then you just take a little bit out of it and mix it with a whole bunch of other stuff to make your bread. And then you're supposed to pass along what's left of the fermented stuff onto somebody else.
Amish friendship bread.
Yeah, that's what it is. Exactly. So I was thinking, is that what this is like? Like you have to make this huge, big thing first. Then you just take a little bit out and then, you know, that's enough. So, so maybe just in the chemical formulation of this, you have to mix up such a big batch. Otherwise it doesn't work, or maybe the amounts you need are so infinitesimal. But yeah, it does seem like a safety hazard, doesn't it, to have that much of that stuff? You would think that much, if a drop can create the singularity, which would envelop a planet or a star or whatever, that as much that was on Spock's little vessel there would like reverse the Big Bang. You know what I mean? Like the whole galaxy would on itself.
Well, at the end of the movie, it does get detonated, that whole mass of the red matter, and that's what creates the lightning storm again. Nero back out and almost gets the Enterprise.
Yes, yes, but like I say, you would think that it would even have been bigger than that, you know?
Yeah.
Like there would have been no escape for anything within light years. But what do I know? I am not an astrophysicist, damn it, man. I'm a podcaster, not a physicist.
Another bone in his... I'm a doctor, not a physicist.
Yeah, he says that. Yeah, he says that.
And then we get to another familiar concept, the Centaurian slug that Nero uses on Pike. It's very similar to the creature that Khan uses.
Aren't those little eels, sand eels or something? Yeah. Same idea. This one goes through the mouth. Oh my God. And it finds its way to your brain. How's it do that? I was trying to think, where's the path to my brain from my mouth?
Probably tunnels through the back of your throat, straight to the spine.
Oh God. I guess. I mean, the ear made more sense, but the mouth, I don't know why they just didn't do the ear. That actually bugged me. I'm like, just commit. Yes, you're borrowing from Wrath of Khan. Do the ear thing. It wraps around the cerebral cortex, you know, rather than tunneling through the back of my throat. Go all the way, man.
Then Kirk and Spock get into a tussle, and Spock just kicks him off the ship onto this moon. Where lo and behold, Spock.
What a coincidence. What a coincidence. And I have wrestled with this. Every time I watch this movie, I wrestle with this. Spock and Scotty, right? And what I come back to is, you know, the theory that there are some constants in reality. I guess even when something as consequential as a lapse or a hiccup in time, some things are just destiny. And, you know, maybe you've experienced something like this in your life where you're like, wow, something was really at play to get me to meet this person or to be in this place at this time. And that's what I just chalk it up to. You know, there was something that was drawing these people together one way or the other. That was something that was going to happen with or without George Kirk surviving or whatever the other, you know, consequences were of those 800 people he saved 800 people, I guess it was, you know, whatever the consequences were for that moment. Those characters or those people were going to find each other. And so that's one of those where you just go, it was meant to be. Because otherwise it seems just completely implausible. I mean, what are the odds? What are the odds? Now, the proximity to Vulcan, you know, that there's, because Nero deposited Spock on that planet because of its proximity to Vulcan, so he could literally watch it, you know, be destroyed. So, you know, but I think it's best just to say it was meant to be.
And that's where Spock Prime talks to Kirk about needing to make the alternate Spock emotionally compromised.
Right.
And then Kirk's just like, what? Emotionally compromised? How's that? And then Spock's just like, I just watched my entire planet get destroyed.
Right.
I can tell you that I am emotionally compromised.
Yeah. Trust me. Trust me on this one. Yeah. Yeah. Because he's not talking about, he's talking about himself. I mean, yes, himself from at a younger age, but, you know, their chances are pretty good that if you were in that situation, you would know how you would feel, right? So that you know, if you only have to think about that one for a little bit, and it makes total sense.
And then they go off to the Federation outpost that's on this moon, where lo and behold, they meet up with Montgomery Scott.
Chief Montgomery
Scott. Played by Simon freaking Pegg.
Simon freaking Pegg. That was what Jimmy texted back to me. He's like, is that the one with Simon freaking Pegg running around with that little turd alien? I said,
yeah, Keezer.
I said, yeah, but the little turd alien is only in he's in it very little bit. Played, by the way, by, oh, I just lost it. I had it right in front of me. Oh, classic little person actor. I just lost it. I was scrolling here on my IMDb. What's his name? What's the character's name? Keenser?
Yeah.
Where is he? Deep Roy.
You don't see it.
Deep Roy.
You don't see it all and in the regular timeline that I know of.
No, he's totally new. But yeah, Deep Roy, who I believe was in Return of the Jedi, and he did the full body shot of Yoda in Empire Strikes Back. There's one shot where it is a little person. And I can't remember off the top of my head what shot it is, but so yeah, that was Deep Roy. I don't know if he was in, I don't think he was in A New Hope. I don't think he was a Jawa. I know he was in Empire doing the Yoda stuff, and then he was Droopy McCool in Return of the Jedi.
Anyway, Spock kind of breaks some rules here and gives Scotty the formula for transwarp transportation.
Also a little bit of a callback to when in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, Scotty gives the formula for transparent aluminum to the manufacturer of, and he says, McCoy, that's right. That's such a great line. You do realize that we are, what does he say? Messing with,
like giving him the formula. Yeah. Altering the timeline irreparably.
Right. Yeah, right.
Why? How do we know that he didn't invent the thing?
How do we know he didn't invent the thing? And he's like, yeah. Oh, the chemistry between Scotty those looks actors. God almighty. So
Scotty
good.
Looks at the formula and he's like, I didn't realize that space would be the thing that's moving.
Right, yeah. No, it's very, very cool. And I love the little callback to Archer and Porthos, because he says that it was Archer's dog, his beagle, that he experimented trying to beam from one planet to another.
I didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, he says Admiral Archer's Admiral Archer's prized beagle. Now it probably isn't Porthos, but it's
yeah that. Did it work? I'll let you know when he turns it.
Yeah, exactly. But that was definitely, you know, Scott Bakula's character in Enterprise they were talking about. But he was an admiral at that point.
And then they are successful in beaming back on board the Enterprise with a slight hiccup in that Scotty ends up inside a water system tank of some sort.
Oh, I get so claustrophobic watching. I'm claustrophobic and I am... And I can't swim. So like, man, that whole sequence is enough just to drive me crazy. But yeah, it's like a gerbil maze or a hamster maze or something that he's in. And what do they call that? The Jeffries tube, I think, in the original series. I think that's what they call all that. I don't know. Anyway.
The act of freeing him out of there is what alerts Spock to the fact that they... have intruders on their ship.
Yeah, right. And it's like, how the hell did you get back here? That'd be the question I would ask. Yeah, and that's when Kirk
has his Spock confrontation.
Crimes. Yeah, yeah. And he admits that he's compromised. And what's because that also threw me is like he uses the same terminology and everything. But again, Spock Prime is talking about himself. He knows how he would react. It's not like he's talking about a different person. And so he knows that if he was in that position, that's what he would, and that happened to him, that's what he would say.
It was Sarek that snapped him out of it.
Right. Yeah. Well, your dad, you know.
And he's actually kind of looking on with this concerned look.
Yeah, it's like, how long do I need to let this act go on? Like, yeah, because he's there for a while. Like, all right, it's getting bad. And Uhura, I mean, by the way, just in general, Kirk gets the absolute living crap beat out of him throughout this movie. It is a nonstop pummeling from beginning to end on that character. He's just, yeah. And he takes it all. I mean, and that's not the end, you know, he gets the crap beat out of him over on the Romulan ship as well. But yeah, it's a great moment, and it's a classic Spock moment where he has to confront his human side in that moment, you know? So yeah, I like that a lot. Very, very believable.
And then after Spock leaves the bridge, Scotty's just like, I like this ship.
Well, you know, the Scottish people are no strangers to confrontation. You know, if you know any Scots, they tend to be loud, gregarious, and you know, the family dynamic with them is very colorful. A lot of friendly and not so friendly arguing and all of that. So I thought that was just, you know, a real Scotsman saying, you know, after the fights are breaking out, it's like, I like it here. You know, I feel right at home.
And then
that Kirk is, I got to say that around. Is one of the beauties. That's one of the beauties of Star Trek. And I regret that we can't do this anymore as much as we used to, but you know, Star Trek, was about infinite diversity, infinite combinations. You know, I think it was called IDIC was the thing. And you had these people coming from these diverse backgrounds, and yet they weren't afraid to show you iconic classic tropes, that represented, you know, you only had minutes in an episode with these characters. And so Scotty played the bagpipes. You know, and Uhura would talk about, you know, her African heritage and her name and what it meant. And she was speaking Swahili and all of that. And it just, I like that they embrace that in this movie. I don't know if this movie was, if it would have been made today, if they would have embraced some of those little character things. I don't know that they would have had Chekhov flubbing his way through those announcements with his, you know, with his accent, or Scotty being kind of, you know, kind of that more aggressive Scotsman. But I like, to me, that's real diversity. That's real diversity when they can be themselves, and whether it's, you know, yeah, I like it. I like it. I think that what makes this movie so great is how much it embraces the characters and their backgrounds. Doesn't run away from it at all.
The last note I had written down was, after Kirk gets the ship turned around, they plan their entry into the solar system to kind of keep them shrouded from Nero's view. And you have this iconic shot of the Enterprise rising out of the gas of
the rings,
Jupiter, I think it is, or one of their moons.
Titan. Yeah. But yeah. It looks very, it's like the rings of Saturn looks like to me. So maybe Titan. I failed astronomy very badly in college. And of course, I took astronomy because I thought, oh, I love Star Trek and Star Wars. It's about space. It's going to be great. And that was a big mistake. I did very poorly. But I do remember that Saturn's the one with the rings. And and I know that Titan is a moon. But yeah, to me, I looked at it and I'm like, oh, it has rings. It must be Saturn. But then they said something about Titan. So shows what I know.
Yeah, just that iconic shot of the Enterprise just rising out of the clouds into view. And they do something similar in Into Darkness as well. I don't remember if that's in the third movie or not, but
well, and it's a lift out of Wrath of Khan when they're hiding from each other in that nebula. That's some of the best. It's very nautical in the sense, like nautical warfare, where you have, or submarine warfare, where you know you're hiding from each other and you're just using radar or sonar or whatever, and there's that great reveal. I think it happens with the Enterprise. First, Khan does it to the Enterprise, then the Enterprise does it to Khan at the end. But yeah, I thought it was a nice little tip of the hat.
Actually, no, that wasn't my last note. My last note was on Spock and Spock. Spock meeting Spock.
Yeah, it's like spy versus spy. Spock versus Spock. I'm so glad they went there. In the scene when Spock tells Kirk, you know, under no circumstances can you tell your Spock that you met me, and it'll, you know, he goes, you lied. I implied. I thought he was going to say I exaggerated, but he says, no, I implied. And I remember seeing it for the first time and being disappointed in that moment, saying, oh, I want to see them on screen together. And, I was so glad that we got that. Especially knowing, you know, how well they got on off screen and how supportive they were of each other. And so I was really happy that they got that moment. And, you know, it was Spock Prime's presence in that timeline that gave Spock non-Prime or whatever, the Zachary Quinto Spock, it gave him the assurance that he needed so that he could stay in Starfleet and not have to be part of the, you know, Vulcan you know, relocation program or whatever it was, the preservation program of the Vulcan culture.
Yeah. The alternate Spock sees the back of Spock Prime and thinks it's Sarek.
Yeah. Father.
And that's when, yeah, I am not our father.
Yeah. Yeah. It'd be wild to be confronted with, like, you know, you at, well, so I think Spock's supposed to be well over 100 years old at that point. Yeah, certainly well over 100 years old. So it's like, wow, imagine being face to face with you at like 160 years. Be crazy. I am old. Look at that. That's what I say. I'm so vain. I would be like, all right, I got to make sure that I keep the eyebrows trimmed. I got to, oh my God, look how big my nose gets, you know. And then he'd be talking to me and I'd be like, what? What? Oh yeah. The thing. I'm sorry. I was just thinking about how big your nose was. Our noses.
And that's all I had on that.
That's all you got. Well, I am so excited to be doing these because it gives me such a great excuse to rewatch these movies. And I love 2009 Trek. I mean, it's not a perfect movie. I think it's cast perfectly. There's not a single actor that I would switch out. I just think, you know, even I keep forgetting his name, so when I say Christian Bale, but even Bana as Nero, I'm not wild about the character, but I wouldn't change it. Now we're going to get into, you know, when we talk about the next two movies, we're going to start talking about characters that maybe I might not have cast the way that they do. But this one, I thought brilliantly cast. I thought it was a phenomenal reintroduction to these characters. And I was looking so forward. When I saw this movie for the first time and it was over, I was looking so forward to the next one thinking, give me a 2-hour episode of classic Star Trek. Give me a one-off adventure. Don't worry about having to tie it into a bunch of canon. This is all I wanted from, you know, Daniel Craig's James Bond series. Give me a singular storyline that doesn't have to link a bunch of stuff together. I want the crew in their five-year mission, exploring strange new worlds, seeking out new life. That's what I wanted. And unfortunately, it just started getting sucked down by the weight of canon and needing to always call back to this and call back to that. It's like every Batman movie needs the Joker. So every Star Trek movie needs Khan now, you know, we'll get into that in the next one. So I had super high hopes after this, you know, seeing this movie for the first time, just thinking, all right, we got our favorite characters back. They're being played by great actors. Let's just have fun with this for as long as we can. Let's just make some great Star Trek adventures. I was naive. Yes, I don't know how Hollywood works. So, but we'll.
But overall, I think it was a good movie.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's yeah, phenomenal, and much like Force Awakens, you know, I still go back and watch that and with great affection. I love the Force Awakens, and so the other two give it a little bit different flavor for me, but not. Not so much that I don't still have a lot of affection for it. Same with this movie. The other two suck some of the joy out of it a little bit, but boy, I had a ball this afternoon rewatching it. I really did. So thanks, Rob, for making me do it. And I'll get onto the next two, and we'll come back and we'll talk about those. Do you have some kind of fancy sign off that you like to do here?
No, not really.
No? All right. Well, how about we just do something... Let's do something very... Oh, yeah. Okay. If you don't... You're not going to see the video of this. He's giving me the Vulcan salute. I'm doing likewise. Live long and prosper. Or as we say here at Rebel Force Radio, we'll see you next time. And remember...
The Force will be with you. Always.
And that's a wrap, brother.